File 49.
Let us examine the symptoms that were evident in Germany at the time that the German people accepted this defeat. Is it not true that in several circles the misfortunes of the fatherland were even joyfully welcomed in the most shameful manner? Who could act in such a way without thereby meriting vengeance for his attitude? Were there not people who went even further, and boasted that they had gone to the extent of weakening the front and causing a collapse? Therefore it was not the enemy who brought this disgrace upon our shoulders, but rather our own countrymen. If they suffered misfortune for it afterwards, was that misfortune undeserved? Was there ever a case in history where a people declared itself guilty of a war, and that even against the better conscience and its better knowledge? No, and again no. In the manner in which the German nation reacted to its defeat, we can see that the real cause of our collapse must be looked for elsewhere, and not in the purely military loss of a few positions, or the failure of an offensive. For if the front as such had given way, and thus brought about a national disaster, then the German nation would have accepted the defeat in quite another spirit. They would have borne the subsequent misfortune with clenched teeth, or they would have been overwhelmed by sorrow. Regret and fury would have filled their hearts against an enemy into whose hands victory had been given by a chance event or the decree of fate. And in that case, the nation, following the example of the Roman Senate, would have faced the defeated legions on their return and expressed their thanks for the sacrifices that had been made, and would have requested them not to lose faith in the empire. Even the capitulation would have been signed under the sway of calm reason, while the heart would have beaten in the hope of the coming revanche. That is the reception that would have been given to a military defeat, which had to be attributed only to the adverse decree of fortune. There would have been neither joy-making nor dancing. Cowardice would not have been boasted of, and the defeat would not have been honoured. On returning from the front, the troops would not have been mocked at, and the colours would not have been dragged in the dust. But above all, that disgraceful state of affairs could never have arisen which induced a British officer, Colonel Repington, to declare with scorn, "Every third German is a traitor." No, in such a case this plague would never have assumed the proportions of a veritable flood, which, for the past 5 years, has smothered every vestige of respect for the German nation in the outside world. This shows only too clearly how false it is to say that the loss of the war was the cause of the German breakup. No, the military defeat was itself but the consequence of a whole series of morbid symptoms and their causes, which had become active in the German nation before the war broke out. The war was the first catastrophic consequence, visible to all, of how traditions and national morale had been poisoned, and how the instinct of self-preservation had degenerated. These were the preliminary causes which for many years had been undermining the foundations of the nation and the empire. But it remained for the Jews, with their unqualified capacity for falsehood, and their fighting comrades the Marxists, to impute responsibility for the downfall precisely to the man who alone had shown a superhuman will and energy in his effort to prevent the catastrophe which he had foreseen, and to save the nation from that hour of complete overthrow and shame. by placing responsibility for the loss of the World War on the shoulders of Ludendorff, they took away the weapon of moral right from the only adversary dangerous enough to be likely to succeed in bringing the betrayers of the fatherland to justice. All this was inspired by the principle, which is quite true in itself, that in the big lie there is always a certain force of credibility, because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily, and thus, in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie, since they themselves often tell small lies in little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the same impudence to distort the truth so infamously. Even though the facts which prove this to be so may be brought clearly to their minds, they will still doubt and waver, and will continue to think that there may be some other explanation. For the grossly impudent lie always leaves traces behind, even after it has been nailed down, a fact which is known to all expert liars in this world, and to all who conspire together in the art of lying. These people know only too well how to use falsehood for the basest purposes. From time immemorial, however, the Jews have known better than any others how falsehood and calumny can be exploited. Is not their very existence founded on one great lie, namely that they are a religious community, whereas in reality they are a race? And what a race! One of the greatest thinkers that mankind has produced has branded the Jews for all time with a statement which is profoundly and exactly true. He, Schopenhauer, called the Jew the great master of lies. Those who do not realize the truth of that statement, or do not wish to believe it, will never be able to lend a hand in helping truth to prevail. We may regard it as a great stroke of fortune for the German nation that its period of lingering suffering was so suddenly curtailed and transformed into such a terrible catastrophe, for if things had gone on as they were, the nation would have more slowly but more surely gone to ruin. The disease would have become chronic, whereas in the acute form of the disaster, it at least showed itself clearly to the eyes of a considerable number of observers. It was not by accident that man conquered the Black Plague more easily than he conquered tuberculosis. The first appeared in terrifying waves of death that shook the whole of mankind. The other advances insidiously. The first induces terror. The other, gradual indifference. The result is, however, that men opposed the first with all the energy they were capable of, whilst they tried to arrest tuberculosis by feeble means. Thus man has mastered the Black Plague, while tuberculosis still gets the better of him. The same applies to diseases in nations. So long as these diseases are not of a catastrophic character, the population will slowly accustom itself to them and later succumb. It is then a stroke of luck, although a bitter one, when fate decides to interfere in this slow process of decay and suddenly brings the victim face to face with the final stage of the disease. More often than not, the result of the catastrophe is that a cure is at once undertaken and carried through with rigid determination. But even in such a case, the essential preliminary condition is always the recognition of the internal causes which had given rise to the disease in question. The important question here is the differentiation of the root causes from the circumstances developing out of them. This becomes all the more difficult the longer the germs of the disease remain in the national body, and the longer they are allowed to become an integral part of that body. It may easily happen that, as time goes on, it will become so difficult to recognize certain definite virulent poisons as such that they are accepted as belonging to the national being. Or they are merely tolerated as a necessary evil, so that drastic attempts to locate those alien germs are not held to be necessary. During the long period of peace prior to the last war, certain evils were apparent here and there, although, with one or two exceptions, very little effort was made to discover their origin. Here again, these exceptions were first and foremost those phenomena in the economic life of the nation which were more apparent to the individual than the evil conditions existing in a good many other spheres. There were many signs of decay which ought to have been given serious thought. As far as economics were concerned, the following may be said. The amazing increase of population in Germany before the war brought the question of providing daily bread into a more and more prominent position in all spheres of political and economic thought and action. But unfortunately, those responsible could not make up their minds to arrive at the only correct solution, and preferred to reach their objective by cheaper methods. Repudiation of the idea of acquiring fresh territory, and the substitution for it of the mad desire for the commercial conquest of the world, was bound to lead eventually to unlimited and injurious industrialization. The first and most fatal result brought about in this way was the weakening of the agricultural classes, whose decline was proportionate to the increase in the proletariat of the urban areas, until finally the equilibrium was completely upset. The big barrier dividing rich and poor now became apparent. Luxury and poverty lived so close to each other that the consequences were bound to be deplorable. Want and frequent unemployment began to play havoc with the people, and left discontent and embitterment behind them. The result of this was to divide the population into political classes. Discontent increased in spite of commercial prosperity. Matters finally reached that stage which brought about the general conviction that things cannot go on as they are, although no one seemed able to visualize what was really going to happen. These were typical and visible signs of the depths which the prevailing discontent had reached. Far worse than these, however, were other consequences which became apparent as a result of the industrialization of the nation. In proportion to the extent that commerce assumed definite control of the state, money became more and more of a god, whom all had to serve and bow down to. Heavenly gods became more and more old-fashioned, and were laid away in the corners to make room for the worship of mammon. And thus began a period of utter degeneration, which became specially pernicious because it set in at a time when the nation was more than ever in need of an exalted idea, for a critical hour was threatening. Germany should have been prepared to protect with the sword her efforts to win her own daily bread in a peaceful way. Unfortunately, the predominance of money received support and sanction in the very quarter which ought to have been opposed to it. His Majesty the Kaiser made a mistake when he raised representatives of the new finance capital to the ranks of the nobility. Admittedly, It may be offered as an excuse that even Bismarck failed to realize the threatening danger in this respect. In practice, however, all ideal virtues became secondary considerations to those of money. For it was clear that having once taken this road, the nobility of the sword would very soon rank second to that of finance. Financial operations succeed easier than war operations. Hence it was no longer any great attraction for a true hero, or even a statesman, to be brought into touch with the nearest Jew banker. Real merit was not interested in receiving cheap decorations, and therefore declined them with thanks. But from the standpoint of good breeding, such a development was deeply regrettable. The nobility began to lose more and more of the racial qualities that were a condition of its very existence, with the result that in many cases the term plebeian would have been more appropriate.